Hello and welcome to the Pall Mall Doughboys podcast, a World War I history podcast keeping alive what is often called the Forgotten War. Coming to you from Sergeant Alvin C. York State Historic Park in Pall Mall, Tennessee, on the banks of the Wolf River. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host today, Park Manager Nate Dotson.
Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart.
We're sitting here with Billy Jack, me and Ranger Tanner Wells, and we appreciate everybody tuning in to the episode today. We've been trying to set up a conversation with Billy Jack for, I don't know, 3 weeks now. But we finally made it happen, Billy Jack. So we're excited to have you join us. Great reenactor that has spent a lot of time with us at York, and we're excited to have you on. So I guess just to give us a little background of yourself, Billy Jack, you're in Elizabethton, Tennessee. Is that right?
Yep. In Elizabethton, got started reenacting at Sycamore Shoals, actually. I was a Boy Scout in Herb Roberts's troop and ended up being in Watauga's and met some other reenactors and got started and went down to Fort Loudoun for the first time and met some crazy man named Jeff Wells. You know, then got into all sorts of different kinds of reenacting.
So it was all 18th century for you at first. Was that something, I guess, like, were you, like in school, was history your thing growing up?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I loved it. The old Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett TV shows and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we found out about British and French and Tennessee and Indians all together. I had to find out more about that.
Yeah. Well, ever since I can remember back, and Tanner's been here longer than me. I mean, we've had Billy Jack at all our events. Most recently, you portrayed a character from Kidnap the Kaiser, Ellsworth Brown, who I thought was perfect for your persona because he had a Fort Loudoun connection.
Ellsworth was an interesting fella.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about his life.
yeah, for sure. But yeah, I guess, so once you got into 18th century stuff, what led you to World War One or getting interested in World War One stuff?
Actually, my great uncle, William Bradley, was a World War One veteran. And my dad's brother, just before he died, had found a picture of him from World War One. And so that got me interested in doing some research on World War One. And then I found out everybody was going to start doing some World War One at Sergeant York. So I might be interested in trying that out too.
So I guess that was like kind of leading up to the centennial. Would that have been like 2015, 16, somewhere in there?
14, 15, somewhere around there.
Okay. I gotcha. We've had some really good events, Veterans Day stuff, and we missed you at the Great War Expo we just had a few weeks ago. Wish you could have been up there for that, but we'll have it again next year. Hopefully you can join us.
Yeah, I'd like to be there next time for sure.
One of the big reasons why we wanted to get you on here, Billy Jack, is to talk the 30th Division, which, as I told you before, I don't know much about. Tanner is... We kind of just defer all War One questions to him.
A little bit of stuff,
but we know that you are. You're the ultimatum when it comes to 30th Division history. And I guess just to get started with all that, which I know I'm sure it's you can talk about it for a long time, but to somebody like myself that doesn't know much about it, what got you interested in just researching the 30th to begin with?
Well, once I started doing research on my uncle here from, he was from Elizabethan also, but he didn't get put in one of the Elizabethan. Well, there ended up being two National Guard companies from Carter County, one from Elizabethan and one from Hampton. And that got me really interested. So I found out about the 117th and how they were originally part of the 3rd Tennessee from the Civil War, even.
Okay.
Before they were federalized, and they'd been to service in Mexico just before they were called up to go over to World War One.
Yeah. What was your sources, like, just doing the research? What'd you use mostly? I mean, just newspaper articles, whatever.
Well, the 30th Division history book is probably the best overall book on that stuff. I also got into some of the British papers that had a lot of the, at least as far down as the regimental orders into them. So I found out quite a bit on that. They even tell the artillery schedules how long they're supposed to fire and at what rate for how long to proceed the attacks, that good stuff.
Great detail, so, then.
Yeah. And then I found that one of the men that served from the company in Hampton had written a book on his service in World War One.
Oh, and that's so cool.
I found a first person account from an East Tennessee man.
What's that book called?
John Cates is the author, I think. It's
okay.
Let's see if I can look it up. It's just called, I think, E Company, Hampton's E Company in World War One or something.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But John Cates, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have to look that up. That's cool. I guess, Billy Jack, just to start at the beginning with the 30th, you know, what little I know, obviously they were National Guard units out of Tennessee, North Carolina area. What happened, I guess, once war was declared? I know National Guard units were called up first. Where did the 30th kind of start, I guess, coming together and getting formed into a different?
Well, they all, I guess they came in by battalions pretty much, but they formed together. Never were really served together by regiment or division until they got to Camp Sevier in Greenville, South Carolina, where they were there for several months training over the fall and winter and early spring of 1918.
Okay.
Overseas.
I guess, were they one of the few as units as well? Did they see any service in the punitive expedition? Did they already have some experience?
Yeah, they were in the punitive expedition. They'd served at least 6 months on the border, just prior to being called up for World War One. As a matter of fact, they were released in mid March of 1917, and then called back up and sent to Camp Sevier in September of 1917.
Gotcha. So they had a few months break, and then it was like, okay, April 6 comes along. Like, never mind. I guess it seems like, you know, from the research I've been doing with the early war stuff, is most people didn't have a whole lot of experience going into the training camps, but it seems like these guys did, obviously being National Guard and having served
in
Mexico.
And it's interesting, they served over there under in Mexico under General John O'Ryan, who ended up being in command of the 27th Division in Europe. And they served side by side, the 30th Division and the 27th did.
Okay.
While they were in Europe.
Okay.
Working together with the
units. Yeah, I gotcha. So you mentioned Camp Sevier. What was that camp like compared to other camps when they arrived? And it was South Carolina?
Yeah. Well, a lot of these World War One camps, they were just so hastily built. Like when the soldiers arrived at Camp Sevier, none of the camp was built. They had to start cutting down trees, making roads, and then they set up the camp as tents after that. They just had to work a lot, real hard before they even started their training.
I gotcha.
Wrapped clothes and uniforms.
I saw Camp Sevier spelled Sevier, S-E-V-E-R-E, instead of the other way, because of the hardships, I guess.
Oh, yeah. And in the wintertime, it just got, when the rain started, it just got muddy and nasty. And all the famous diseases ran through there, you know, measles, mumps. It's just rough on everybody.
Yeah.
Ended up canceling the Christmas furloughs and all that type of stuff.
One question too I had, what would be the, like, percentages, if you know, or if this information's even out there, of, you know, how many Tennesseans versus how many North Carolinians or whatever? Do you know the percentage that it was made up of, or is that kind of just they know that it was
No,
units?
I'll give you sort of an example though, like the Hampton and the Elizabethan units that left from here had about 150 men each in them at that time, and they had recruited up from 100 since they left Mexico, and they'd still weren't up to the current company strength, which at that point was still just 200 men. They hadn't went up to 250 men per company yet. And they ended up sending drafts of people who had been drafted from Des Moines, Iowa, and Camp Gordon, and a few other places, and sent them to finish filling up the regiment as well. All the regiments. I think there was I think 24% of the 30th Division was people not from the South at all, other areas in general.
The one guy's experience that I've looked into, and I think I've talked to you about him before, but he was from here in the valley. His name was Van Williams, and he did that exact path. He went to Camp Gordon, was only there, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks, and then was sent to Camp Sevier. He was in the 117th, if I'm remembering right. So yeah, he served in the 30th from the valley itself. And that's, like I say, the only dabbling I've done in 30th Division history is through his story. So pretty cool.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So once they get trained, are they some of the earliest transports over to France?
Yeah, they're fairly early on the list. I mean, like you've got the 32nd and I believe the 27th Division were over there first, and a couple of other National Guard divisions, but not very many. They tried to send regular division, all the regular divisions they could first, before the National Guard, but there wasn't a large number of them either.
No.
So it was. And that's why they drafted the men from the other regiments, because they were closer to sending the 30th on, and they were needed to have them up to full strength.
And they've at during this time too, they've adjusted division strength sizes from like the traditional approximately 15,000 going upwards of 25, 27,000 men. And one of the things that I always found was interesting with the 30th was 30th is sent over, but it's never put at the new full strength tally. I think it only ever peaked around 13, 14,000 men at the most. And so while they're in Europe and they're being pushed to the front line, they are never put at full strength. And when the first, it is always
Once the
interesting to
New
me.
Jordan campaign began, the even Pershing wouldn't allow any more replacements to go to the 30th Division or the 27th. None of the if a division wasn't fighting on the Meuse-Argonne front, they didn't get replacements.
It always came across too. It's like not even that. If it is it, it almost found from some of the materials I'd come across, it almost felt like Pershing was resentful of the British and the French by retaining American divisions, because when they're creating that first army and they're pulling all these divisions into it, the 30th and 27th are reluctantly left under British command. And of course, you got like the 93rd and others that are under the French. And he doesn't want to leave them under them. But when he has to, and it's insisted that he has to, he's like, well, I'm not putting these up full strength. And so they just never are. And which always makes it more incredible, because the 30th sustained so many casualties over the course of their campaigns in a year span, and they're highly decorated and recognized, but they were never at full strength, and yet they accomplished feats that full strength divisions couldn't.
Yeah, that's a good point, especially in those battles on well, October 7th, 8th, and 9th were some of the big days for the 117th, especially. It was the day they were at end of the battle.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely want to get into like some of their big engagements, but one thing that stands out to me that, you know, listeners that may not know anything about them, Tanner mentioned it briefly, but they're not under American, or they're not under the AEF command. They're under the
British command. How did that come about, or why did that come about?
Well, there's still an American command up to the Corps level. The whole Second Corps is under American command. You know, like we was talking about earlier, Pershing didn't want to give up the men. He sure wouldn't allow the take his men piecemeal, which was the original scare. They wanted to separate them into regiments or smaller and divide them up. So he wouldn't allow them to go smaller than divisions. But even then, it still ended up being core size groups that he would only allow under them. Also, now,
going along that same line, I have not come across anything specific, but have you come across anything that kind of ties in why those two divisions are selected to remain under that British command structure?
No, I think it was just the luck of the draw. They were at the right place in their training and still had their British arms where they'd been training under British officers and stuff. Mm. And they were he's like, we'll just leave them there.
I gotcha. Yeah, the
he took the artillery, like the artillery section of the 30th Division went with the and were followed in the Meuse-Argonne.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't with the infantry.
Okay. Yeah, the I guess something that might stand out to somebody if they know what they're looking at in old photos of War One is the soldiers of the 30th are carrying, as you mentioned, British arms. They've got a little bit of different equipment issued to them. Have you come across any like what a soldier in the 30th, what he thought about his equipment that was British or anything like that, like personal stories of that?
Well, they didn't really like turning over their American equipment for British. And that was their biggest fear, that they were going to be left with the British instead of joining the American army. And it ended up happening to them.
So their nightmare came true France. Nice.
Yeah, especially the food. They didn't care much for the British rations. It seems.
I don't even think the British soldiers liked the British rations.
They were probably given a ration of rum, right? They had to be okay with that.
Well, this is funny because I've looked for this everywhere. I've read regimental histories of the 118th and the 119th and the other regiments in the division, and they're getting rum rations, but I've never found any evidence that any of the 117th were able to get their officers to let them have the rum rations.
Oh, man.
Now, going along that same line, I did come across a couple of occurrences where men would trade because they are next to Australian regiments and Canadian regiments, where they would trade what they could to get rum rations. So they're still getting their fix. They weren't apparently not even as lucky as the other regiments.
Yeah. Oh, man. What was their, as we were talking about some of their big engagements that they get thrown into right away, was it the Meuse-Argonne? Did they do anything prior to that?
They weren't. Only the artillery was in the Meuse-Argonne.
Okay.
They served with the Second Corps in Flanders.
Okay.
Their first duty on the line was actually up near Ypres. They served around Zillebeke Lake and in that area. And I think the 118th actually got into some actual combat operations, but it was quiet on the line when the 117th were on the line. Now, I think they did receive several gas casualties and things like that while they were up there. But then they moved them down and took them for a little bit further east, closer to the Somme.
Okay.
So the 30th, some regiments are in the front line. They're seeing some action, while others aren't. But they are still part of
the rotations, of course, on the front line.
And they'll get those rotations in. But are they a part of any major operations of any kind under British command? Because I know pretty much everybody is once the Grand Offensive begins, which is about the time of the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, and everyone's pushing hard.
Yeah.
But are they part of any other engagements prior to that? Because, like, when you look at the AEF, we can look like Saint-Mihiel and Catigny, and we can look at these other engagements or operations. But what do we know about the 30th
No, the 30th weren't really involved in anything other than those small little actions at the right up around the Ypres. No, when their first actual combat was on September 26th when they started the Grand Offensive.
Okay.
Yeah, they were at at Bella Court where the where the tunnel was, and they were on
near San Quentin Canal line and that whole stretch.
Yeah.
So their task was basically like they put them on the Hindenburg line. Was that their area during the Grand Offensive, or when was that in the timeline?
Yeah, that was during the Grand Offensive. On the 117th was in the reserve on the 26th on that day, but they received a special assignment because they had to go down. Once they crossed the canal tunnel, they were supposed to go to the right and meet up with the Australians and clear the area between the tunnel and that flank.
What was fighting like in that section, St. Quentin?
All the reports say that between the fog and the artillery shells, that they couldn't hardly see. All the companies got intermixed and entangled, and it was a real big mess for a long time. They finally got them straightened out and were able to push through and meet all the objectives. But it was a confusing time. They even lost a few tanks and things like that, just from running them into places they couldn't get out of.
I gotcha. So it's through October that they're going to obviously get their most casualties. Like, it seems like most American casualties were right there in October of 1918. The little brief amounts that I've read, the 30th suffered a lot of casualties, especially in that month of October. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, now the offense, when the offensive was moving up on the October the 7th and 8th, near Premont and Bisigny in that area, they got into a bad place where the Germans had a lot of machine guns up on the railroad embankments, and they just made a lot of trouble for them. Took a lot of, like you said earlier, a lot of guys from the 30th ended up with a lot of decorations because of that, for bringing up Lewis guns and things to try to get those guys out of the way.
Yeah, I know
a lot of officers were killed and command kept evolving on lower and lower ranking officers all the time, enlisted men.
Yeah, because from some of the casualty accounts, you know, it's like they're somewhere around 13,000-14,000 men, and then in total casualties, the 30th Division sustained somewhere around the ballpark of like 8,500 men, which is a pretty good percentage of casualties for that division, considering it never gets to full strength. But breaching the Hindenburg line was always described as kind of this difficult nut to crack. So we got boys like Milo Mert down in Crossville, who was with the 117th breaching the San Quentin Canal line. And he'd be a Medal of Honor recipient from his action that he'd be posthumously awarded. That whole stretch, that's for a brief period of time, they sustained a lot of losses.
Well, that canal tunnel, they said there was over 100 entrances coming out of it where they could fire from and stuff like that. It's just
from all the photographs and stuff, it seems heavily concreted.
They heard them too because of that. The Germans couldn't see them as well and things.
Go ahead. Sorry, Billy Jack.
I said that's probably why they still had enough men left to go on into October through those offensives.
Yeah. So like you said, after that, the canal, do they just kind of keep pushing forward like everybody else is doing? Where do they go from there?
Well, they go forward for just about two more days. So they got leapfrogged by the Australians shortly after they past the canal, and then they stayed following them for about a day and a half, and then they were pulled off the line and not brought back to the line until October 5th, which was only about 6 or 7 days, but they underwent more training between then, especially did more tank liaison training and stuff then.
Okay.
So they're like, not all infantry regiments really had armor attachment, because it's kind of a new thing. We don't have very many of them, but they had armor attached. Was it American armor or was it British armor that was attached to them?
Well, it was really, it was British armor for the most part attached to them, because all the American armor was with the French. They didn't.
Yeah.
They were using the FT-17s for the most part instead of the big British tanks.
Hmm. Okay. It's like when you brought that, I was like, oh, most of the poor souls pushing through the Meuse-Argonne are going without armor. And then you get
E Company from Hampton was one of the companies selected from the 117th to be an armor liaison company.
Okay.
Because they did best with it in training.
And wow. So they did training. So this training is going to be behind the lines, and they're coordinating with British. What all do you know what all that type of training consisted of?
Mostly from what I've been reading, it's being put in tactical situations and having to solve the problems to get through those situations.
I can just picture some of those assessments being like, who can walk fastest with the tanks, you know?
Well, now for the tank liaison stuff, they had to know all these different signals and how to signal the planes with the tanks and all sorts of.
And then I wonder too, like, kind of catching up any of their men that, you know, were replacing officers lost up to that point, and trying to maybe reconfigure some of the units and stuff like that. Due to casualties, would that have been a part of it?
Oh yeah, and that's one of the weird things in the 30th Division book. It never mentions any of that, how that happens. Anything about that? There's no official transfers of men from one company to the officers from one company to the other. Okay. But like one of the lieutenant from the Elizabethan Company who left here. I can't think of his name right now. Lynn Folsom ended up getting a British Military Cross for his actions with Company L from out of Etowah, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And on October 17th or 18th, one of those days. And he was, none of his materials that I've seen ever shows where he was transferred out of the Elizabethan Company or anything else. He came back from France as the captain of the Elizabethan Company.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, like I mentioned, the one guy that I've looked into, Van Williams, he's 117th, and he is killed on October 17th. And I think when I was talking to you, Billy Jack, some time ago, that was basically the last day they were on the lines, and they were pulled off the lines after that point. So extremely bad timing for Van Williams. But from what I was reading about, his company, and I can't remember which company he was in, but there was they were not on the line. But there was a company that had, I think, ptomaine poisoning, if I'm saying that right. And, they were pulled off the line because they were all sick, and then his company had to fill in. And this is the morning of the 17th or the evening of the 16th, something like that. And then he was killed that next day. So, you know, I don't know what ptomaine poisoning is, or how you get it. I think like canned meats or something.
I've looked it up, and that, what was called ptomaine poisoning then is not known to science now, or. It's probably just kind of food poisoning,
Yeah, kind of food poisoning.
Came from the canned food.
Okay, yeah, so another British ration complaint there, getting ptomaine poisoning, or this mystery disease that you had no idea about.
Mystery disease from mystery meats that you're eating.
I believe that was one of the Knoxville companies that got pulled out for being sick.
Oh, is it?
But I think it was Company D, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, that, yeah. And so anyways, yeah, Van Williams, I went to Knoxville and looked at the veterans wall there, and his name's there on the wall in Knoxville, but he is buried here in the Wolf River Cemetery, or at least he has a headstone here. So that doesn't seem like that was the case for everybody being brought back home, but anyways, I'm kind of getting ahead of it. But so yeah, they fight through October. Are there any actions at all on the 30th, in early November, even up to the 11th?
No. After the 18th, they come off the line. I believe it's midnight, after midnight on the 18th of October, and they didn't go back on the line again. Wow. They went back and were in training again until when they found out about the armistice.
Yeah. And so, as Tanner talked about a little bit early on, is all the different commendations of the division. There was medals of honor. There was all these other things. Are there any people that stand out to you from the 30th?
Oh, there's, like to say, all kinds of guys from the 30th. Calvin Ward, and, you know, I guess he's probably the most famous guy from 117th. There's several guys from up in this area that none of them actually got medals of honor, but they got silver stars, and or they're not silver stars, I guess, distinguished service crosses.
Yeah,
and think about it, like when it comes to like medal of honors, of all the ones that were decorated from Tennessee, a good portion of those are simply from the 30th division, you know, because you got Joseph Atkinson, you got Milo Lemert, you got these slew of guys that are spread from around the state that were part of the 30th, and it's in many ways makes up over half of, and there's 110,000 Tennesseans that served in World War I, and they're in different divisions, and it's this handful, and most of them were, in essence, serving with the 30th during its time of action. And then, as you're pointing out, their time of action is fairly limited, especially when you look in comparison to some of the other American divisions that were serving in different operations throughout the summer campaigns and were in action. But as a whole, the Americans in general don't see as much as, say, a lot of the other European allies. But no, it's pretty fascinating. I like Nate was talking about, there's, of all of them, though, is there any specific story that stands out, whether they're Medal of Honor recipients or not, or if there's just a funny story that you're familiar with that you'd like to share?
Well, there's actually several, but
we're all ears.
I can't remember some of the exact details of some of them now. One of the most interesting things that I read about was Mr. Cates and his thing from talking about being from Hampton. The first time they saw planes fighting in the air, he said it was better than any fireworks show they had ever seen in Hampton before. He also said a couple of guys had swiped some extra rations and went out in the field and were building a fire to cook them and got fired at. Luckily, nobody got hit, but didn't have to tell them again not to be doing those things.
It's always fun to learn things the hard way, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was a real interesting guy. He said, you know, when I was a kid, everybody played war all the time, you know, I guess it's standard. But to him, that was something new when they got to France. Mm-hmm. Him and one of the other guys went out walking around, and he said all the kids were playing war, and he had never, it was like it was something new and interesting to him. Mm-hmm. He said a plane flew over, and him and his buddy jumped in the closest hole they could find, and all the kids just went on playing like it was.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I guess just used to the war-torn France that they lived in. That's pretty crazy. What did he do after the war once he got back home?
Well, after he got home, he was ended up being like a school teacher and stuff. Did all sorts of different things. They even they kept getting together every year, the Hampton Company did, until the 60s at least.
Okay.
And then he wrote his book in the 60s.
Okay.
And actually his niece helped him write it. It says that she transcribed it in the book, but she comes into my store sometimes and she says that she wrote it. So.
Hey, that's pretty cool.
For a long time, yeah.
That's really cool. I guess so. Another kind of interesting character that would have served, I'm assuming, attached to them was Luke Lee with the 114th Field Artillery. He was attached to the 30th, yeah. Correct?
Yeah. Well, the 30th, all the 30th Artillery companies were attached. Were sent okay. To the French side.
Okay.
The
So he was in the Meuse-Argonne. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we as we mentioned at the beginning here, we had a program called Kidnap the Kaiser, and we had Billy Jack out there with us. He was representing Officer Ellsworth Brown, and it was pretty cool. We told the story of the 114th and what they did after the war was over, trying to kidnap the Kaiser in, I guess, when was that? January of 1919. But when did the 30th get shipped back home? When was it all over for them? Did they have to hang out for a long time?
Well, they felt like it was a long time because they were there not doing anything but having to do military duty. All the war was over with. They ended up being put in quarantine for a while and things like that because of various diseases. But they ended up going home fairly early in March. The 30th were one of the first divisions to go back. And from what I've heard, it's because of Luke Lee and those guys going to try to kidnap the guys.
Oh, okay.
Who knows?
Trying to get the troublemakers out as soon as possible before they do something else.
These guys need to get out of here now.
Yeah. Man, that's really cool, Billy Jack. I definitely feel like I learned something about the 30th. I just dabbled a little bit, but I want to read Mr. Cate's book. I think that'd be really cool to get into. Oh, yeah. And, can't wait to have you back out in the next few months. Already got our Veterans Day plans going, so we'll have to I don't know. Maybe we'll have you highlight the 30th at Veterans Day or something.
Well, I'll have to have some better notes with me or something.
Well, you'll just at least carry around a Lee Enfield, and we'll just be like, that guy's 30th division.
Yeah, so, no kidding.
Well, cool, Billy Jack. Anything else you want to add? We definitely appreciate you being on.
Not that I know of. Thank you for having me, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.